But today is VE Day. The war is over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The worldwide web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Well Show. I'm Sophie Downs and I'm joined today by Rachel Griffin, Head of Tax and Trusts at Quilter, to discuss the policy changes the firm hopes to see in the upcoming autumn budget. Now, our timing is impeccable. As we're recording on the back of an impromptu speech the government made this morning, where it looks like Rachel Reeves might back down on some of her manifesto promises. So let's unpack this a bit to begin with. Why is this so significant? And what does it tell us about how things have shifted over the past year?
I think what's significant is it's not normal to have the Chancellor kind of give us the context of the budget. We would normally have to wait until budget day to actually kind of get any context at all. So clearly, the Chancellor is kind of setting us up for what's to come. And that feels like, and I think many commentators are saying, that we're going to see a change to the manifesto pledges. I don't want to predict which one of the three main taxes, but it does feel like we're being given the kind of the leeway to say things have changed. You know, yes, I said at the last budget that there wouldn't be any more tax rises, but the world has changed. And I want to put that out there today so that, you know, everyone realises when I stand up at the dispatch box that actually what I'm going to say is in the best interest of ordinary people and for the long term as opposed to the short term. So I think she just wanted to really set the scene for us. I think in terms of what's changed, obviously the OBR are going to downgrade things. We also have the political backdrop of, you know, high interest rates. We've got high government debt. So it feels like if we don't see that kind of the one big hitting of the main taxes, then actually we would have had a myriad of, you know, hundreds, I think that I saw reported hundreds of tax tweaks. So actually it's probably the right thing to do, but of course it's reversing that manifesto pledge. And it was interesting this morning that she talked very much about her ironclad fiscal rules, but at no point did she mention the manifesto pledges, which, if you recall last year, just before the budget, every single MP was, you know, talking the mantra of those manifesto pledges. So I think we have to be prepared for that.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we don't know exactly what manifesto changes may be made, but there seem to be a lot of reports about income tax rising. I mean, if this was to happen, and again, this is speculative, mm-hmm. but how much of an impact would this have on investors?
I think, again, the income tax one's an interesting one because we might see two main ways in which we could see changes. We might see the reversal of the income tax threshold sort of unfreezing in 2028 and actually pushed out again to 2030. Again, that's a kind of a stealth tax. We kind of see more taxpayers coming into the income tax net. And purely that's a kind of a little bit more less transparent, let's say, than perhaps putting a penny or a couple of pennies on the income tax rates. In terms of how investors will react to that, I think, again, there's so much speculation. I think, I've never in the last two budgets ever had, I think in my whole career, the amount of speculation that we've seen. And I think in terms of investors, I think, you know, so we did a survey with customers actually not that long ago and in October. And one of the kind of key things that people were concerned about was income tax raises. But on the other hand, least it would be one and done, as opposed to lots and lots of different things.
And that speculation point is key. I mean, obviously the budget's a lot later this year than it is typically. From your conversations with clients and advisors, what do you think people seem to be most worried about?
I think the thing they're most worried about is the uncertainty. And, you know, I'll keep repeating that probably today, but it's just the fact that people have put in place plans that they feel that they were able, you know, whether that's 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, you know, long-term plans. And actually, each and every budget, they're having to revisit or reassess those plans. And certainly, you know, we're still reeling from the changes to the IHT and pension changes, which obviously don't come into play until the 6th of April 2027. You know, investors are doing things today that they perhaps wouldn't have ever even envisaged, but for those changes. You know, we're seeing people taking pension commencement lump sums out of their pensions and looking at different ways to mitigate inheritance tax because of that. So it's kind of that uncertainty, I think, which is the key thing. Equally, income tax and IHT are the two big taxes that people are most concerned about, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've spoken about the potential of them being targeted in the next budget. Mm. But aside, I guess, from the manifesto pledges, there's a whole host of rumours flying around about what the government might do to tinker around the edges. In your opinion, which of the reports that are circulating are most likely to appear, would you say?
I think my answer will have changed, having listened to the Chancellor's speech this morning. I think we will see the income tax thresholds pushed out by a couple of years. I think we will also see income tax rates increased. Aside from those, I think we'll also see things like, ISA simplification was always going to be on the cards. We were always expecting to see something from that. But in the last month or so, we've also seen rumours about cash ISA and whether we will see that reduced down by, you know, from 20,000 down to 10 or 12,000. There's also kind of a resurgence of the sort of so-called British ISA, whether we'll see some compulsion into UK equities. Alongside that, I think we'll see some tweaks around inheritance tax. There are also rumours around the pension. You know, there's always rumours around pensions, to be fair, but whether the pension commencement lump sum might be reduced. Again, that's pushing behaviour. People are getting concerned and spooked around those things.
Let's focus on the ISA simplification regime, because I know this is an area that Quilter is quite supportive of. Obviously, the ISA has become a lot more complex over time. What do you think is one change, maybe the easiest change Rachel Reeves could make to restore simplicity?
We were hoping to see some kind of merger between the cash ISA and the stocks and shares ISA. And what we mean by that is actually by aligning the rules that sit within cash and stocks and shares, actually for those cash savers, it stops people having to make those decisions about, oh, should I invest in stocks and shares or should I invest in cash? And actually, once perhaps a cash saver was invested in a combined ISA, let's say, it wouldn't be too far a leap to then kind of go into stocks and shares. And especially when we see the introduction of targeted support, you might actually see people, you know, or providers actually being able to help clients to move from that kind of cash mentality into more of a stocks and shares mentality. But if you're asking someone to change a product set, that's always a little bit more difficult. Equally, I think also just by having the simplicity of both the cash and the stocks and shares together, things like transfers, things like the administration, just becomes so much easier for people to understand. And I think it doesn't feel like a barrier then. It feels like a much easier decision for people to make.
I think that simplification point is a really interesting one. I mean, we're hearing, as you said, a lot about the British ISAs, where they'd be required to contain exposure to US equities. Mm-hmm. Where does Quilter stand on this idea? Is that feasible? Is it practical? What do you think?
So, I mean, there was a consultation paper on the British ISA, and, you know, that was pushed well and truly back by the industry in terms of the complexity around how you would monitor it. A compulsion to 20-25% in UK equities, interestingly, kind of harps back to the old PEP days when they first introduced personal equity plans, and the whole purpose for those was to get Britain investing into UK equities. It was complicated, because imagine someone today goes into an investment and they meet that sort of whatever that de minimis criteria is. But you've got to monitor that. You've got an ongoing monitoring of that. If it falls below that, you've got to contact that individual and tell them they need to do something. Invariably, there'll be rules around that. So you perhaps might only have 30 days in which to correct that before your ISA no longer meets that requirement. So it just builds in complexity. So one, you've got that complexity. And two, actually, if we look at our book of business today, our ISA book of business, there is a natural UK equity bias. So actually, you don't need to do anything because you're already, you know, stocks and shares investors tend to go into that kind of or play to that UK bias anyway. Equally, it's also one of those things where, you know, you're not going to move cash investors into stocks and shares by just making people invest in a certain amount of UK equities, because actually the underlying problem is that Britain is a cash saving culture, and we need to look at how you move people from that to an investment culture through, you know, financial education, through, you know, targeted support hopefully will help that. But if, as providers, we're having to spend all our time building systems to monitor this, we're not doing those other things that will truly help turn that dial.
So the focus then, I suppose, should be on shifting behaviour, and that behavioural piece as much as it should be about its kind of structural reform. I mean, doing that, though, it has to be said, is obviously no small task.
Absolutely.
How, from your perspective, can the industry work with the government to kind of deliver on that behavioural aim?
Yeah, I think targeted support is certainly a move towards that. I think also by, you know, getting behind any kind of government financial education plans, which are, I think there's plans to kind of start pushing things out from the government next year. Equally, as the industry, we're always looking at ways to kind of, you know, engage with investors, you know, help them to kind of make the right decisions. And I think, again, it comes back to having that certainty as well, because if you haven't got that certainty of sort of tax policy, then actually you lose some trust from investors. So it's also kind of not just about, I guess, education. It's also about having a clear plan, as in from the government, in terms of what's coming next, so people can feel confident in what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. And that simplicity it brings us nicely, I suppose, to that broader point about long-term planning. In one of the calls Quilter made to the government was for a tax planning commission to kind of avoid these really piecemeal tweaks each budget seems to make. Tell us a bit about that. What would a commission fix? Why is it important?
So if I go back to sort of 2022, in September 2022, we saw the Office of Tax Simplification disbanded. And at that time, we were the premise was that the requirement to simplify the tax code sat within the government institutions, Treasury and HMRC. However, we haven't seen that simplicity coming out. In fact, we've probably seen the exact opposite. You know, examples of that are the lifetime allowance changes, the IHT and pensions changes that have come about. You know, people are still grappling with what that might look like. So having an independent tax body that perhaps has, a twofold, where firstly, they can look at the tax codes with no fiscal implications of doing so. So, you know, you're not looking to remove taxes, but actually by simplifying the tax code and therefore making it easier for people to understand. And then secondly, you have a body that actually can scrutinise any of these tax policies and kind of really draw out the kind of the complexities before they actually kind of land in legislation. So again, we're trying to build the idea is that you build confidence and trust in the tax policy, and people can then make informed decisions for the, you know, short to long term to be able to feel confident that actually, you know, they're not going to be investing in something today and then next year it, you know, everything goes up in the air again. So that's the sort of the premise behind it, is to kind of have a bit more certainty around tax policy.
Do you think that would do enough to restore confidence in the system?
I think it would go some way to do that. You know, certainly I think that you know, having something that you could look to and you would felt that it was kind of the purpose behind it was kind of fairness and you know, growth and clarity on what's happening. But, you know, we've got a long way to go in terms of, again, the tax policy and what the kind of the long term looks like. So it's a starter. It's a definite starter.
Let's shift focus to some of the other areas you believe need addressing. One of these is gifting, which is, of course, very pertinent against this big international wealth transfer we hear about so often. I mean, we've spoken about the changes last year, particularly bringing pensions under the scope of IHT. How much of an impact has that been having over the past year with clients, with how they're concerned about it? What has it looked like for Quilter and their clients?
So certainly on the IHT and pension changes, I mean, people have used pensions, obviously, for retirement, but they also have been used as intergenerational wealth transfer vehicles. And people, you know, since the changes, we are definitely having different conversations with advisor and different conversations with clients in terms of how they might use their wealth differently. So perhaps previously you might have left your pension, you know, you might have spent your ISAs, you know, in terms of when you needed to draw down an income, you might have gone from your ISA or other investments before you got to your pension. Whereas actually, I think there's a significant shift now that people realise that actually they're going to have to draw from their pensions earlier if their sole purpose is to kind of try and mitigate inheritance tax. And certainly, I mean, both on the run up to last year's budget, and we've seen this throughout the whole of this year as well, people looking, as I said earlier, to draw out their pension commencement lump sum and actually, you know, take that out and perhaps invest in other investment vehicles, whether that be bonds, whether that be kind of even gifting that directly away, because people are so concerned about losing a lot of their wealth in inheritance tax. I think one of the, with the gifting part of the question, I think, again, you know, we're also seeing kind of questions about how people can gift efficiently, and things like gifts out of normal expenditure. So with pensions, because you've never had to think about pensions in IHT gifting, you know, people are asking questions like, actually, can I gift some of my pension commencement lump sum on a regular basis? It doesn't affect my standard of living. Does that meet the gifts out of normal expenditure? And the difficulty with inheritance tax is it is complex. And sometimes you don't even know if you've saved or mitigated IHT until someone's died. So it's also that kind of difficulty that people are trying to kind of grapple with in terms of saving IHT on one hand, but also not knowing about it until after someone's demise.
And on the one hand, I suppose we've got all these kind of shifting rules and minutiae of detail around all these taxes. But then on the other hand, systems haven't been updated for years. I mean, you've previously called the current gifting rules stuck in the 1980s. What practical problems do you see them causing advisors and clients today?
So, I mean, the gifting rules are, you know, I mean, not just the annual exemption, which has been stuck since the 1980s. We've also got the other exemptions like the nil rate band, which again hasn't changed in the last 20 years. So they haven't kept rate with inflation. You know, so something I think today, you know, the annual exemption, for an example, is £3,000. If it had uprated in line with inflation, it would be around the £12,000 mark now. So actually, you know, for house prices, you know, to take into account house prices and inflation rises, the gifting rules are just not fit for purpose. And anyone who wants to actually make a gift, again, perhaps you want to help your grandchildren with a house purchase, well, £3,000 isn't going to get you very far in terms of the current housing market. So actually having, you know, a review of those gifting rules to make them more relevant for today, and therefore to help that intergenerational wealth transfer, is hugely important. And especially with the cost of living crisis, again, you know, one of the key questions we get from people is, you know, how can I pass on wealth? And it is generally to help someone to purchase a house or to pay for university fees, etc. So it's not just, you know, it is for a purpose that's going back into the economy anyway.
And the 3,000 figure is kind of mind-blowingly low.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned the 12K would be a kind of fair if it was in line with inflation. Do you think that would be the correct amount for it to be raised to?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, you've, again, inheritance tax is a kind of a complex web of lots of different exemptions. So, you know, it's, if you have the annual exemption, you've also got other exemptions that you can use. The good thing about the annual exemption is if it was 12,000 or 20,000 or 20,000, you know, I'd love it to be, you know, 12,000, you know, 50,000 even. But, you know, I'm trying to be realistic. But you get certainty with the annual exemption. And what I mean by that is I know that if I gift to you, Sophie, £3,000, £12,000, that is exempt as long as I don't go over that amount. However, with the other, some of the other exemptions, I think I just mentioned the gifts out of normal expenditure, you don't actually know if you're going to get that exemption until after death. So, you know, that's why the annual exemption is so valuable, because it gives that certainty, whereas the other exemption, not all, but some of the other exemptions, you don't get that certainty until after death. So that's, you know, that's why the annual exemption, as you say, though, today, it's a token gesture. It's not really achieving what it was intended to do.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if the 3,000 annual exemption was updated, what kind of behavioural shifts do you think we could expect amongst older clients?
I mean, I certainly think with the backdrop of that IHT and pensions, deadlines are looming, we would see more gifting. We're certainly seeing that anyway, but I think it would encourage people to make outright gifts more. I think we would also see the fact that people would kind of look to perhaps engage more with financial advice as well, because they could kind of see that actually by doing, and it's not necessarily investing in another product, it could be outright gifting, they could actually kind of save inheritance tax as well. I think also we would see people perhaps, again, just engaging with their own personal finances and being able to kind of make good choices in terms of what they might want to do. Because equally, you know, people might not want to gift any money away, but they know their options then. And there's more, again, back to that certainty and that trust and confidence. They can kind of trust and have confidence in what they're doing.
And we've spoken a lot about kind of the stability in policy and sustainability, I suppose, for the longer term. If you had to sum up your message to the Chancellor in one line, what would it be?
I think I would say having a tax policy that is for the long term. And to be fair, in her speech this morning, the Chancellor talked about not being short-termism and having that long-term outlook. You know, that would be welcome. So I think I would say if we could have a steady ship for the next, you know, 3 to 5 years, as long as the parliament lasts, that would be what I would ask. And I think that would mean that people could gain confidence and traction in terms of their saving and their taking control of their own financial sort of well-being.
Mm-hmm. And in particularly in light of the news this morning, are you optimistic that this budget could be a turning point? Or do you think, you know, there will be some scope for some kind of short-term fixes?
I think the Chancellor used the word tricky. I think it's going to be a tricky budget, and I think we will have some opportunities in terms of for advisors and clients to fulfil their long-term goals, but I think it's going to be a challenge. I think it will be a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all we have time for. Thank you so much for joining us today,
you.
Rachel. And we'll see you all next week.
Apollo 11 has
tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth: cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.